This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. All eyes are on the FCC ahead of Thursday's vote to repeal net neutrality and reshape the internet. What will it mean for internet users in Bloomington Normal?
If you look at the big telecommunications provider, you look at the AT&T and the Verizons of the world, part of this is a jealousy.
GLT's Ryan Denham talks with ISU economics professor David Loomis and another expert about what happens to your beloved Netflix after the big vote. Find out why Governor Bruce Rauner is playing the victim to Democrat Mike Madigan. It's an edition of the IPR Politics Roundtable. And Charlie Schlinker has a preview of the Economic Development Council's BN by the Numbers presentation this week. He talks with economist Mike Doherty about the job loss in the community over the last 8 years. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 11th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Federal Communications Commission will vote Thursday on a plan to undo the landmark 2015 rules that had placed internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon under the strictest ever regulatory oversight. The vote is expected to repeal so-called net neutrality rules, which prevent broadband companies from slowing down or blocking any sites or apps, or otherwise deciding what content gets to users faster. GLT's Ryan Denham has more with two Bloomington Normal experts on what this change could mean for local internet users.
I'm joined in studio by Mark DeKiersgeeter, Executive Director of the Central Illinois Regional Broadband Network, or CERBN. Also by Mix and the Executive Director of the Institute for Regulatory Policy Studies at Illinois State University. Mark, David, before we even get started, we might want to explain what net neutrality is. And no offense, but I'm going to outsource that to John Oliver, a host of HBO's Last Week Tonight. He's a comedian, but he did a pretty good job with his explanation on this particular story.
Net neutrality is actually hugely important. Essentially, it means that all data has to be treated equally, no matter who creates it. It's why the internet is a weirdly level playing field. And startups can supplant established brands. That's how Facebook supplanted MySpace, which supplanted Friendster, which supplanted actually having any friends. Do you remember physically having friends? It was awful. You couldn't tap people's faces to make them go away. The point is, the internet in its current form is not broken, and the FCC is currently taking steps to fix that.
Mark, I'll start with you. Is John Oliver's explanation of net neutrality in broad strokes accurate? Is that about right?
Yeah, I would say it's a good, you know, quick answer, an elevator speech answer.
How would you describe it?
I would say there's three main things with net neutrality. It's really about blocking content, it's about throttling content, and it's also about paid prioritization.
Mark, what effect do you think our history with net neutrality, having it in place, has had on the internet, how it's developed, how companies have sprouted it and grown in that space?
Well, it is an equal playing field, and so that gives everyone an equal chance to put their site up and have people access that, or to provide a service and be able to sell their service on the internet.
David, this issue has been an issue for years. That John Oliver clip we just played is 3 years old. But now that we have a Republican-led FCC, it may actually happen now. Can you talk at all about the history of this particular regulatory issue a bit? In other words, why is this keep coming up and why now?
The FCC first set a set of principles for net neutrality back in 2010. So it's been at least 7 years, and they discussed it for many years before that. So this isn't a new issue, but the question is, legally, how do you do that at the Federal Communications Commission? They try to do it with the internet labeled as an information service, and so that has a class of rules. And the court said, no, you can't impose these rules if it's an information service, because the law is set up such that information services have very light regulation. And so then they changed it and said that this is a communication service, a common carrier service. That holds a whole bunch of other regulations, including price regulation, profit regulation. And the FCC said, well, we're not going to do all those things, but we are going to impose these principles. And now what they're reversing and saying, you know what, we don't want to label the internet or internet service providers as common carriers, so we're going to dismantle what had happened before.
And Mark, I think a lot of people in our community associate you with the internet for obvious reasons. One of the reasons we brought you in today is you're the executive director of the Central Illinois Regional Broadband Network. What kind of questions are people asking you about net neutrality over the past month, and how worried should people be about this?
Yeah, while I'm out at chamber and economic development events, I get asked quite often, what's up with this net neutrality? What is it really? And I usually get a disclaimer like, you know, can make it easy so I can understand this. And so, you know, I kind of go back to the three main tenets I kind of led with: blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization. And so when you can go through that quickly, kind of in a little elevator speech, if you will, it helps people understand it pretty good like that.
Are people asking these questions in a concerned way? Are they just curious? So what would you say their kind of sentiment is?
I think from a consumer standpoint, most people, you know, a lot of people use Netflix or another streaming video service. And that's the biggest threat I think most people from a consumer standpoint have is, what is this going to mean the way I consume content now? You know, the latest internet stats are from back in 2015 show, if you Google it, that about over one third of all traffic is video streaming. A large chunk of that's Netflix. You can't find anything newer than that on the internet as far as the stat goes. But what I can tell you is that on our own network for Serban, keep in mind many of our businesses are, many of our clients are businesses, organizations, municipalities. We do have universities, colleges. We also support internet service providers that do sell residential service. About two-thirds of all of our traffic at any given time is Netflix traffic, or I should say video streaming. It could be Netflix, it could be Hulu, it could be something else, but about two-thirds at any given time is video streaming.
For folks who may not even know what Central Illinois Regional Broadband Network is, could you just kind of give us a quick recap of what Serban is exactly?
Yeah. When President Obama was elected the first time, he had the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act to kind of get the economy going again. And in that act, that grant, they had what was called the Broadband Technology Opportunity Program. And they earmarked money to develop rural broadband for areas that were not served with fiber or high-speed broadband or were underserved. So it was really geared towards rural markets. And three guys from ISU who were already searching for better bandwidth and faster, cheaper, et cetera, applied for a grant and got $17.6 million. ISU received that grant. They built out the Serban network, and then once the grant was completed at the end of 2013, all the assets were transferred to Serban LLC, which owns and operates the network.
And that's what you're running?
Yes.
How would the end of net neutrality affect Serban?
It really wouldn't affect us at all, and the reason why I say that is there's two things. First of all, you know, we're mission-built to provide access, and that's our mission, and a large focus of that is educational opportunities for children, K through 12, college, university, community colleges, et cetera. And so back to our mission to begin with, you know, we wouldn't get into the business of throttling or blocking or anything like that. We use the internet as an economic development tool for the communities we serve. So we wouldn't do anything on our end. And when we think about our upstreams, you know, we purchase upstream internet access in major metropolitan area. We have multiple upstream providers in major cities, in multiple cities. And the way we have a relationship with them, where we're already paying them for that bandwidth, it's highly unlikely that they would be doing any throttling or anything like that, because where we're buying it in the common, the carrier hotels, it's very competitive. There's multiple carriers there. Net neutrality is more focused, in my opinion, a lot on the last mile providers. And even though we're a last mile provider, that's not, you know, we're net neutral now, and we would remain net neutral regardless of what regulation may or may not do.
Do you think that the end of net neutrality would potentially change the mix of offerings for internet access in Bloomington Normal? Right now, for a typical consumer, it's probably a Comcast, maybe a MetroNet if their neighborhood has been built out by that kind of upstart fiber operator. What do you guys think in terms of what this could potentially change in terms of offerings for your average consumer?
I really don't think it's going to change all that much for most consumers, because I don't think that many of the providers are going to have an incentive to move off of net neutrality. The problem that you're going to have is that you will you have what economists call information asymmetry. That if I do get throttled or if I there's a problem, I don't know whether the problem is on Netflix server side. I don't know where it is in the backbone that I'm getting slow access, or whether that's in the last mile. And it's only the service provider that really knows what they're doing in controlling traffic. So even though I'd like to have a free market solution, you're not going to have one because I can't really get the information that I need to make a good and solid choice. And the second thing you pointed out, you have a limited number of providers. So in a competitive market, you need a lot of different providers. So I think the market would discipline providers to say, no, we're going to stay net neutral. And then there might be a provider that says, hey, we'll offer you Netflix and you'll never have a queue. You'll never wait at all. And somebody might say, gee, you know, 2/3 of my traffic is Netflix, maybe 100% of my traffic is Netflix, and I want to go with that provider. But the choices here, and we're not atypical, is very limited in terms of the number of providers that you can go to. And so you could get forced into a choice that you really don't want.
I think that's a really good point that David makes in that, you know, I know a lot of times people are very frustrated with their residential internet service. But the fact that there are, depending on where you live in town, literally, you know, three, you know, maybe four options for internet service in Bloomington Normal, that's not typical. There are many people that I talk to, they have one choice and that's it. And when you have one choice and that's it, a provider would have, would be more apt to make some sort of decision where they could capitalize more by making different service classes or throttling things.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here in the studio with Dave Loomis, professor of economics at Illinois State University and executive director of its Institute for Regulatory Policy Studies, as well as Mark DeKiersgeeter, executive director of the Central Illinois Regional Broadband Network, or CERBN. Where would we see potentially the first changes when folks hear about something like this and there are maybe concerns about what this could mean for me, the average consumer, there's a lot of kind of doomsday speculation about this is going to change everything. But like, what would be like maybe the actual first thing we might see change in day-to-day life as a kind of an internet user?
Well, I don't think you're going to see much change really at all. I don't think the providers are going to change much. And just remembering that the FCC's backtracking on these principles, but it doesn't mean that really net neutrality goes away. It means that the federal agency that's going to get oversight for this is going to shift from the Federal Communications Commission to the Federal Trade Commission. The problem there is the FCC has at its disposal more people to monitor, and they can impose heavier fines. And the Federal Trade Commission acts more as kind of a last stop regulator. Somebody has to complain and say, you know what, I think something fishy is going on, here's a problem. And as we said before, that's really hard for the average consumer to really know that. And so I think we're going to, if firms do treat traffic unequally, it's going to be a long time before we know that they've done it and see something before the Federal Trade Commission. And so I don't expect anything to change in the very near term.
What impact do you think this could have on startups and these kind of younger tech companies who've historically relied on that kind of equal playing field that the internet is sort of notorious for?
If you look at the big telecommunications provider, you look at the AT&T and the Verizons of the world, part of this is kind of, my opinion, is a jealousy. They look at the Netflix, Facebook, Google making tons and tons of money, and they're not making so much money. And they're like, you know, you're leveraging all our assets. We do the hard work. We lay the fiber. We dig the trenches. And all you do is have a little server farm out here, put up an application that everybody loves, and we're not making the money that you're making. And so they want to have what economists call a two-sided market. We want money both from the end user, but we want money from Facebook, Google, Netflix to help support the broadband network that we've built out. And so I don't think it's really the startups, the small startups. I think everybody says, yeah, this is good. It's those small startups that have come to be huge, huge companies that are making large amounts of money that, in a certain sense, the internet service providers are jealous of, and they want a slice of that pie. And the way that they do that is paid prioritization. We will get with Amazon, you're going to make money on this customer. So if you pay us some extra, we'll make sure that you have no interruptions and all of your pages load instantly. But you give us a slice of the pie.
So, Mark, the FCC chairman said during a recent interview on NPR, talking about the end of net neutrality, and how it might impact small towns where there aren't that many choices for internet service providers. He said that heavy-handed regulation is not the solution here, and that companies say they want to invest in these rural, smaller, low-income areas, but it's a hard business case to make with net neutrality in place in the way that it is today. I guess, do you buy that? What should we think of that kind of that argument?
First of all, I think the amount of investment to lay fiber is something that a lot of people underestimate. You know, Serban's network was built out with $17.6 million, and it hit rural communities that if we didn't have that grant money, they still would not have any fiber assets in those communities. And when you look at a map of central Illinois, we're talking about places like, you know, Pontiac, Illinois, Towanda, Lexington, Eureka, Gridley, you know. You know, back to we were talking earlier about the number of providers within central Illinois, we're really kind of blessed not only in Bloomington-Normal, but just the fact that ISU had the foresight to apply for that grant and be able to build out this community resource. So back to the rural communities, I think there's a big struggle there because, you know, for the carriers to maintain the existing infrastructure they have and then deploy new infrastructure into a rural area like that, they're a business. They're going to want to make sure they have a return on that investment. And so I just see, you know, it depends on the size of the community, and it's purely a numbers game whether or not they'll have funding to hit certain areas with fiber.
Ed, I don't think that net neutrality is going to change that investment equation. It's expensive to lay fiber. Any technology that you're going to get in rural areas, you're going to have to go long distances from one customer to get to the other customer, as opposed to, you know, in Chicago, customers are just densely packed, and so you can address a million people in a very short amount of space, and it lowers your cost per unit of serving those customers. Net neutrality is not going to change that. And just to Mark's point, the Google tried to do this and rolling out Google Fiber in many cities, and now they've stopped because they thought we could do it cheap and we can service the customers, and they found that, yeah, it's really expensive and we're not going to do this anymore.
The industry average, and it fluctuates by states and things like that, but to bore fiber underground in a downtown area where you're going to be, you know, cutting concrete, breaking up asphalt, digging down, exposing utilities all along the path, things like that, it can be $10,000 on average per city block. And then as far as a rural area goes, you could plow fiber in for about $10,000 per mile if you're not boring underneath driveways or other roads along that path. And so the cost to build out a community, you know, you look at the infrastructure going in Bloomington-Normal now, it is very expensive to do that.
David, you've alluded to it in a couple different ways with your references to Google and the content providers. But from a regulatory standpoint, can you talk a little bit more about the various sides that there are when it comes to this issue of net neutrality?
Yeah, it's generally the largest internet service providers, the, you know, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, and others that would be in favor of doing away with these net neutrality rules. And part of that, I think, is associated with this common carrier status, what's called Title II, in the FCC's jurisdiction, and say, no, we're worried about what else might come. And then there's certainly providers that are looking at new business opportunities and being able to have that. I think the biggest thing is the pay prioritization, where they can get additional revenues from those that provide the services, not just their end-use customers. most of those who are providing those services, say the Netflix of the world, the Facebooks, line up on the other side that say, we like net neutrality, we want to keep it the way that it is, because of, obviously they don't want to pay more money, and they're dubious about what additional services they're going to get for this pay prioritization. It's already, in general, pretty fast, at least sufficient for people's use. And so I think, you know, we've got video streaming down pretty well. Netflix works great at my house. I can do that fine. Sometimes when I'm on my wireless device and I try and watch Netflix when I'm not getting good reception, I remember what Netflix used to be like at home and how I'd have to wait. But I think people are generally satisfied with that. As we get more and more video content, we might see that bogging down more the way it used to be. You know, so if Facebook has video in your news feed, if you're getting more and more, you know, YouTube, you have more Netflix. And as that moves up, so if you get 4K, if you're going to get higher resolution, that's more bandwidth, that, and it might slow down again, you might see a push on the consumer side to say, you know what, I'd be happy to pay a little bit more if I always get my Netflix exactly the way and when I want it.
Yeah, so the days of the $8.99 Netflix monthly fee is almost been too good to be true for the last couple of years anyway, and now it may be coming to an end. Dave, is there anything that the states can do in their legislatures if they do not want to see net neutrality in its current form die? Or is this something where the FCC and now the FTC pretty much has control over an issue like this?
We don't have correct legislation. So I think, and I don't think it can be a state-by-state thing. I don't think there's an Illinois issue. I think you need to have federal legislation that's more modern, up-to-date with where the industry is now, but more importantly, where are we headed? And if you want net neutrality principles, you got to write them into the law and say, this is the agency that's going to enforce them, and this is just the way it's going to be. And so I think we're long overdue. I'd like to see federal legislation that says, what's our guiding principle in terms of telecommunication? How does wireline and wireless mix? And where are we going to move forward in terms of new technology for the coming decades?
Mark, any closing thoughts for you as consumers who are listening to this and wondering how they should be thinking of this net neutrality issue? It's going to be in the news a lot in the next 2-3 weeks here.
The FCC is going to take a vote on this. Everybody knows that. And the thing I would say is the internet's not going to stop working the next day. It'll still be on. It'll still work. You'll still be able to stream things. You'll still be able to send email. And regardless of how the vote shakes out, you know, business will continue on as usual. If the net neutrality tenants are removed, I believe, much like David said, you know, we're talking about really large carriers and the carriers that will probably want to go back to certain companies that leverage the internet to make a lot of money, more money than what more money than what the carriers are making, or that they want a slice of that pie, I should say. And so I think from a consumer standpoint, you know, people should be comfortable in knowing the internet's still going to be on, they're still going to be able to use it. And we've got a number of providers here in Bloomington Normal, which means with competition, the providers here will have to remain competitive if they want to keep people's business.
Yeah. That's Mark DeKeersgieter, the executive director of the Central Illinois Regional Broadband Network. He was joined in studio today by Dave Loomis, the professor of economics and executive director for the Institute for Regulatory Policy Studies at Illinois State University. I'm Ryan Denham.
The FCC's vote to undo the net neutrality rules is set for Thursday. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Bloomington Normal has lost thousands of jobs over the past near decade. Get a preview of the latest Economic Development Council's BN by the Numbers presentation this week. Charlie Schlinker has the interview ahead during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. The campaign for governor is in full swing. GOP incumbent Bruce Rauner is accusing Democrat candidate J.B. Pritzker of hiding millions in income, though Rauner himself is very wealthy. Pritzker is retaliating by refusing to, quote, get in the way of this governor's self-implosion. That's discussed by this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Matt Dietrich of PolitiFact and the Better Government Association, and IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, who says Governor Rauner, meanwhile, is blaming House Speaker Mike Madigan, saying Madigan is in control of the state, not Rauner.
Yeah, well, this is basically his theory of the case for why he should be reelected, and people, in his view, should elect more Republicans to the Illinois House of Representatives. He believes, has come to believe, both as a matter of political strategy and, I think, it seems to be a sincerely held belief that Mike Madigan is the root of everything that's been wrong with Illinois government for a few decades. And the way the governor views it, nothing can really change in the way he would like to see it change in Illinois government until House Speaker Michael Madigan is retired or otherwise leaves office. And you're right. It's an interesting thing to hear from a governor because you don't, you know, normally you would expect a governor to say, I'm in charge. Here's the great things I'm doing for our state. It's unusual for the governor to sort of take on a victim role and say, hey, I wish I, as he literally said, I wish I were in charge, but I'm not. Shrug.
Right. And Brian, this is what we heard this week about I'm not in control is really a reiteration of a theme that came up very prominently back in March and April when people started asking the governor and the governor's top staff, how is the state better off now than when you first took office in 2015? And I recall vividly hearing Bruce Rauner telling reporter Amanda Vinicky that the things that I control are better off. The things that I can control are better off. And I also recall a Senate committee hearing in which I think it was Michael Hastings asked Rauner's former chief of staff, Richard Goldberg, asked him, can you tell us how is the state better off under the Rauner administration now than it was before Rauner came into office? And Rich Goldberg's answer was, the things that we can control, where the General Assembly hasn't gotten in our way and interfered with everything, those things are better off. And they were pointing to things like we started the department, the DOIT, the Internet Technology Department, and they talked about things like criminal justice reforms. And it was a very strange answer, because what it was basically saying was, listen, if you take the legislative branch out of this, things would be great. They're interfering with us. And it really, to me, just struck me as a very strange way for the chief executive to respond. And he was, in effect, what he was saying even back then was, well, I'm not in control because they won't let me.
Foiled again by the three-branch system of government.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing that I found so interesting in the comment, because on the one hand, no, of course you're not in charge. Our system of government is set up on a three equal branches of government. No one is total control. We don't have a dictatorship. And the governor sounds like that's what he needs, where the legislature will do what he tells them. And I think it comes from his experience in the private sector where, yeah, in fact, his minions, his underlings did kiss the mistletoe whenever he asked. But in this situation, you came in knowing that Democrats, the other party, controlled the legislature. So your choice was either to work with them or opt for the route that the governor took, where he demonized them, particularly Speaker Madigan. And I look at it this way. The agenda that the governor is pushing, his pro-business, anti-union agenda, even were Mike Madigan to disappear, even had there never been a Mike Madigan, Democrats are not going to turn on labor unions. It's just that simple. I've said it before. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm a lifetime member of the Chicago Newspaper Guild, so I'm very pro-union. but I think most Democrats are too. It's part of the DNA. You're not going to turn against the unions just because some equity investor says that you ought to because he wants to be in control. Yeah, on the other hand, the governor of Illinois constitutionally has more power than most governors in other states. His framework is such that, for example, he is supposed to propose the budget. So he sets the tone for the discussion of the state's spending. He has the ability to organize the executive branch, not the attorney general, not the comptroller, not the secretary of state, not the treasurer, but all the agencies of state government. He has the power to reorganize them as he sees fit. He is the one who decides on contracting. What contracts are we going to let? What rules and regulations are we going to have? So he has tremendous control over that portion of state government, which the Constitution says is his to manage. But no, and he does not have control over the legislative branch nor the judicial branch.
I would say it goes even further than that, Charlie, because not only does he have the sort of official power that you've talked about, but at least for the first 2 years he was in office, he had a lot of power over Republicans. They stayed with him. They were in lockstep with him on almost every single vote. Every time that Democrats tried to override, I think there were only three successful veto overrides.
And one of them he went along with.
Yeah, right. He would have to sort of back. He would kind of say, "Okay, I'll release you guys to do what you want to do." But he had tremendous lockstep support from the Republican Party. And I mean, think back to Rod Blagojevich. He would have loved to have the sort of Democratic support when he was governor that Governor Rauner had from the Republican legislators. It was only after the budget impasse dragged on for 2 years, and after there seemed to be a perception that, the state was about to fall into junk bond status, and maybe the governor would never be satisfied with a deal. That's certainly the message Democrats were pushing this summer, that you had 16 Republicans vote with Democrats on some portion of the budget and tax increase and the veto overrides necessary to override the governor's veto of that budget.
Well, you can't lose sight of just how much not having a budget hamstrung all of the things that earlier in the spring, the things that Governor Rauner was calling accomplishments, like, for example, criminal justice reform, that, yes, there was an aspect of that he signed the bill. There were Democratic lawmakers that worked along with that because it was one of their goals as well. But the problem was you also had a situation where, you know, one of the criminal justice reforms, you want to keep people out of prison, right? And you want to give them the skills while they're there to keep them from coming back once they're out. Well, community colleges provide a lot of the classes that work in the prisons. And during the budget standoff, community colleges across the state were chronically underfunded. And so some of them pulled people out. They couldn't offer those classes in prisons anymore. So there's an example where, you know, the budget, not having a budget, comes back and really disables what you know, one of your accomplishments should have been. You know, to an extent, I sometimes think that, you know, maybe in the private equity world, the dealings are a zero-sum game. You know, somebody wins, somebody loses, that's it. Whereas political negotiations are very different. The goal should be that both sides come away feeling like, I got what I wanted out of this deal. And I've never gotten the sense that the Rauner administration has dealt that way.
All the Republican governors up to Bruce Rauner were able to find middle ground with Speaker Madigan and with the Democratic leadership in the Senate. And so the anomaly appears to be Bruce Rauner, who comes in with, as Matt said, the mindset that it's not enough for me to win, you also have to lose.
Charlie Wheeler directs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Also on the Illinois Politics Roundtable this week, Matt Dietrich of the Better Government Association and IPR's Brian Mackey, along with moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Normal lost 9,000 jobs in the last 7 years.
That's part of the economic picture being laid out this week by Economic Development Council economist Mike Doherty. Doherty talks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about that and the shorter-term look ahead in the BN by the Numbers presentation at the EDC luncheon on Thursday. Doherty says state sales tax for Bloomington is up significantly in the third quarter, but down for the town of Normal. Putting them together, it's about a 2% gain for the year so far for the community. The differences between the town and the city happened, Doherty says, because certain sectors are more active than others.
It is notable that the automotive and filling stations, which are driven by gasoline purchases, were up significantly in the third quarter for Bloomington. So that may have played a role there. And over in Normal, you had a decrease. Well, you had about the same decrease in general merchandise, but you also had a 10% decrease in automotive, 4% decrease in drugs and miscellaneous, and decrease in agriculture, which exceeded the change in happened over in Bloomington.
How about the housing sector?
Well, housing was also good news. A 3% gain, basically, in existing home prices, the average price of those homes. Comparing the last summer, which is your prime season for real estate and for existing home sales, summer of 2017 compared to 2016, up 3% price gain on average in terms of the average sale. And in fact, in some other months, it was higher than 3%. If you really measure cumulatively, going back to January all through October of this year and compare the housing numbers to 2016, you'd see an almost 6% increase in the price of our existing home sales. So I thought that was quite good. The new homes, there was a decrease in the number. Price did not really change. So that market continues to be pretty weak compared to what we used to have here in Bloomington Normal.
Which allows us to transfer seamlessly into employment. For this session of Bloomington Normal by the Numbers, and you can go to that luncheon on Thursday at the Bone Student Center at ISU, you are taking a longer look at the labor force, going back to 2000 or 2010. What does this longer look show us about the health of the workforce?
Well, I think that we need to keep in mind that our labor force peaked back in 2010 at over 105,000, and we're down about 9% from there. So that's in keeping with declines in labor force nationally and with the state of Illinois and with surrounding communities. So within that context, you can look at our total employment, which in May was just below 94,000, but by October, which also tends to be a high point, was still just below 94,000. So, you know, that's where we peaked out at. But we have a low unemployment rate, 3.9%, and that puts it under 4%, one of the lowest unemployment rates in the state of Illinois. And so on the one hand, we are rebounding a little bit since 2015, 2016 in terms of total employment numbers.
Which was when the Mitsubishi plant finally kicked the bucket.
Correct. So we've rebounded a little bit back to those kinds of levels, but we haven't rebounded back to, you know, the longer term historical highs that we had back in 2010 and 2011.
We've lost 9,000 jobs since 2010, or as you said, about 9%. Mm-hmm. We've talked before, and it is a national trend that the baby boomers are retiring. But what else is going on with that shrinkage in the employment numbers?
Well, in terms of the various sectors, it's been an up and down thing. Obviously, manufacturing, Bloomington Normal took a big hit on, and that's down significantly from what it was in those highs. On the other hand, financial activity sector, which includes State Farm, really has been holding its own in the last two or three years, and that's a good thing. It's really only down in that sector, only down 3 to 4% from what they were 8 years ago, and in fact, it's higher right now for that financial activities sector than it was 3 years ago in 2014 when it fell to just under 20,000. So that's a 20%. Of our job sector or employment sector right there.
State Farm down a little bit, manufacturing down a lot. Where does the rest of the disappearance of that 9,000 jobs come from?
I think that takes in the bulk of it. The other ones, we've got professional and business services sector. That one is down from what it was. We had significantly higher numbers in professional and business services back in 2011 and 2012 when they were at their peak at over 11,500 jobs. So
that probably is also State Farm, because they were in the middle of their digital reinvention and had a lot of consultants, which are professional and business services. It's not finance, insurance, and so forth, even though that's the sector they're working in because they're contractors.
I would agree. Yes. It's those cottage industries that surround State Farm. Where we have had some consistent recovery is over in hospitality and leisure. I assume that has to do with the hotels opening up in Normal and maybe other bookings. You know, they are now just under their last peak, which was in August of 2016 at 12,000 jobs. That's about 12% of our county. The other decline was in the government sector. That now accounts for only 17.5% of our employment in the Bloomington-Normal area, whereas it used to account for a little bit over 18%. So it's down 0.5% or more as a percentage by almost 1,000 jobs decline in that area.
Right now, municipalities and the county are in the middle of budgeting processes for the next year, and they're coming in for some public comment flack at meetings about the way they're handling it. They're talking about cutting services. They're talking about, at least in Normal's case, raising the levy, a tax levy, to help pay for pension costs. Bloomington is struggling with a structural deficit of about $3 million that's expected to balloon if left to go unaddressed. Given the shrinkage of 9,000 workers since 2010, and given the shrinkage already in the government employment sector, what else should they be doing to address these concerns?
Well, I would say it looks like they've already addressed them as far as their ability to cut back on the number of people they employ in the government sector. We've got probably as great just as much need today or more than we had 10 years ago or 8 years ago for government services. I don't think it's declined any. You could even argue that people expect more every year from government services than they do a little bit more each year in certain areas. And yet they're doing it with 1,000 jobs less than their peak 8 years ago. It looks like they've already increased their efficiency quite a bit.
Do you expect this trend to continue of a shrinking workforce overall?
Well, we could hope that it's going to level out a little bit on the labor force, but probably not. In fact, if you look at the numbers for the state of Illinois, and particularly the Chicagoland area, which makes up the bigger part of our state, if it were not for immigration, we would have even bigger declines. We're basically being saved by immigration, with a portion of that being international immigration. Overseas immigrants.
This leads us into the thicket of immigration policy
yes,
in the Trump administration.
Yes.
So are you saying that the Trump administration policy to restrict immigration is counterintuitive in an economic performance?
It's not helpful. It's not helpful to states like Illinois, where we have actually lost population. We're in the opposite boat than, say, California or Washington State, which have had large influxes and fast growth rate and crowding out of housing and things like that, and unaffordable housing. We're not in that boat. We're in a state that progressively over time, our housing is getting relatively cheaper for the jobs we have than are the East and West Coast. And at the same time, we're having a bit of a decline in population. So when you look at the downstate counties that lose population, you looked at Chicago, DuPage last year lost population, which is incredible. We need all the people we could get to move to Illinois, and we have the kind of housing that basically can accommodate them.
Political leaders tend to ascribe their own values and economic philosophies and put them on the economy. Is that really what's going on here, or is what we're looking at a continued fallout from the Great Recession combined with demographic trends?
That last statement is how I look at it. This has to do with where the Midwest is at relative to the national economy. It has to do with a continuing trend away from manufacturing in general and toward the digital economy. It has to do with increasing international competition for wages. So I don't see it as being tied. You know, economists will almost always tell you, Charlie, that however the economy performed in a given year really had very little to do with who was in the White House or even in Congress. The bigger effect, you know, in the economy of the United States where it can really be affected by is what the Federal Reserve Board does, because they can shift interest rates. And once they shift interest rates, you affect everything. So a lot of this is going to depend, in fact, getting back to what is the U.S. economy going to do. First of all, we're doing really well. We're at around 3.5% GDP growth rate. It's been very, very good. It's going to be interesting to see how the Federal Reserve responds to if there's a big tax cut, what they're going to do in response, because they can put the brakes on that through the interest rates.
Mike Doherty is an economist for the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Atlantic Credit Union, offering the member business advantage with a team of dedicated member business advisors and specialized products and services designed to help small businesses thrive. Details at MidAtlanticU.com. This is GLT.
A community orchard celebrates the past as it grows for the future. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
You have a chance to help an organic garden grow in a food desert. Matt Erickson of the Come Together Space wants folks to come together in Mom's Orchard, a free orchard for the community located on West Washington Street. Erickson is inviting community members to make a donation to the orchard in celebration of loved ones who have passed. Erickson started with his own dedication, hence the name Mom's Orchard, and that's plural, as well as possessive.
It's named for, of course, my mother and the seven moms I was actually raised by.
By seven moms?
Yeah, I didn't have a father, so my mom, who worked two jobs throughout her life, had me raised at a few other households, and these were also, of course, my grandmother, and then other single moms or moms that were separated, and they all kind of led me to where I am.
So were they instrumental in giving you the love of the land?
Oh, yeah. Well, the love of lots of things. They all had particular things that they instilled into me, all seven of them. So that just culminated to a great thing, yeah.
When did Mom's Orchard start?
We bought the land and started working on it in October 2015.
Why start an orchard?
It's located on the west side of Bloomington, which is a little bit of a food desert. There's a bodega nearby where people go to buy their chips and candy and soda.
You're on West Washington.
West Washington. It's 826 and 902 West Washington. I just wanted to provide a spot where if people were just walking around or walking to the bodega, we could hopefully get them to stop and pick some fresh organic fruit for free instead of going and buying cheap chips and pop.
So it's significant, this location. You chose it because it is a food desert in that area. How much, Matt, does it cost to continue Mom's Orchard? Money doesn't grow on trees, but money does make trees and plants grow.
It does, and I'm doing this as a service free, so that means we have to have other people, of course, pay for the
sponsors.
Trees and bushes, sponsors.
Yeah.
So it's a dedication orchard. So I have a dedication request outline that I can email or give to people. We had such an overwhelming response a few weeks ago that I no longer have space for any more trees, which is great.
Oh, wow.
But I have plenty of space, about 25 to 30 spaces left for fruit bushes, which a medium to large bush costs $75, but that includes the bush, the dedication brick, which will have the dedicated name in it, and the name of the variety of plant, and then things like peat moss or root stimulator to kind of help get it going.
So let's talk about the plants that you have in Mom's Orchard. Tell me about the curation process and what you selected to go in there. I mean, you made some very specific choices.
Yes, very specific. The major thing is to have it very diverse, because we want things that people aren't familiar with, unusual, maybe they haven't even seen before. And I've been working at Henry Brockman's farm for 15 years, and his specialty is diversity. So I've just had that instilled to me. And that also helps for disease control, pest control. So it makes it easier on the work, makes it better for the plants. And again, it just, you know, gets people to try different things that they haven't had before.
So give us some examples of what you've chosen to put in Mom's orchard, Matt.
Yeah, so far we've got Blushing Star Peach. Yeah, which is super delicious. Stanley Prune Plum, Blue Crop Blueberry, a cane apple. And we'll be dealing with in the future apricots. We're even going to try nectarines, cherry, and odd varieties in those things.
So how does it all work, Matt, for somebody who wants to get involved?
They contact me via email, which is the word vision, V-I-S-I-O-N, 714@hotmail.com. I can give them the sheet, and they fill out the name of the person they want it dedicated to. And it doesn't have to be a mom that's passed away. It can be anybody. And then I'll be buying all of these things this winter, but then receiving them in the spring, and we'll do a large planting in the spring. And we'll have the dedication brick ready to go in with the plant, and we'll get it going for the rest of its life.
That's Matt Erickson of Mom's Orchard in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Matt Erickson has hopes for the future. He'd like to establish another Mom's Orchard in Normal in the coming years. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Find the full Sound Ideas podcast and individual stories and interviews at our website, WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.